Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, the home of cycling, brought to you by Zwift, where fun is fast. I'm Graham Wilgos, and Brad, we're back in Bath.
We are
back on TV for Eurosport and GCN, and we're all back for the first Grand Tour of the season.
Yes, and we've got all the Chinua with
us. All the Chinua.
Chinua, sorry.
Close enough, yes. Bradley.
We brought a new energy to the studio. It's good to have you back.
Thanks, good to be back.
You've put up with Brad all day.
Yeah.
And now you're joining us for the podcast. So thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. I haven't had to put up with Brad. Like, I wouldn't put it like that, though. It's only day one, so it's been good so far.
Wait till day two.
I was going to go for day 21. All right. Day two, we'll plunge early.
I should ask then, because Brad, it's been a few weeks for you and me as well. How are you both?
Good. Yeah. Yeah. It's nice to be back, actually. And it doesn't seem like too long ago we were at the Giro the last time, was it, when Teo was doing his thing? So, what is it, 7 months? Yeah, and it's nice to have it back in May. You know, we get that kind of mix up of, you know, who's going to target what race and whether they do the Giro Tour double and this, that and the other. But already, what a brilliant start. Philippe Ganna.
A superstar, and we'll come to that. But all first, we should really start your welcome back party.
All right, let's crack open the...
Let's go.
The champagne, yeah. Well, how was your sort of reintroduction to the UK? What's the process been for quarantining? And because Amsterdam is your base, obviously.
Yeah, very straightforward, really. So I flew over on Sunday, and then I had to quarantine for 5 days. But it's been... And then I did an early test to release thing, but it's actually been... Dare I say, quite pleasant. I can say this because my husband probably isn't listening from Amsterdam.
He's on the line now. Hans, are you there?
No, I've got two young kids, and my usual life is trying to juggle work with family life. So it was actually quite nice to just lock myself in a room for 5 days and just work, you know? So it's been very refreshing. I had my yoga mat out. I've been doing my yoga, my meditation. I'm feeling very zen at this stage. So yeah, it's been good.
Good.
And I don't have COVID, which is always the advantage of quarantine, because you've got to test yourself, and it's always the most healthy I feel when my negative test comes back.
So what have we missed, Brad, while you and me have been away? Amstel Gold, let's start with that.
Amstel Gold, Wout van Aert, but more importantly, Tom Pidcock.
Yeah, and
I mean, everyone is fully aware of how good he is and how good he's meant to be, you know, how good he's going to be, but I say how good he's going to be, he's already there. I think it's the closest finish ever in cycling, would you? One off?
Well,
but there was quite a few different sort of, I saw a few different photographs.
Yeah, different angles. Yeah. But it was really reminiscent of the women's Brabantse Pijl a few weeks before it. And I think that actually, although I couldn't find confirmation of it, but I think that the fraction of a second, which is like 4,000 or something, was exactly the same as Brabantse Pijl. But it's the closest in men's racing, certainly in a long
time. Tom won as well, didn't he? Tom won the Brabantse Pijl.
Yeah.
So what a start to his professional career. Ex-Team Wiggins rider, British Cycling Academy rider, and he's got some, you know... Big, big days ahead of him. I'm telling you, that guy's going to be something special in cycling.
Yes, and an awesome start to his Ineos career too. I mean, they're going to be...
I mean, you know this team well.
So what are they going to be looking at now? Will their plans for him have changed given his performance over the spring?
It could well be, and I think cycling's like that now. It's as good as you are, you get your chance, really. And I think Teo proved that last year. And Remco, of course, Egan Bernal winning the Tour at 21. You know, these... you know, we've got Pogacar, you know, of course, won a few weeks later. The sport is getting younger and younger from the point of view of not having to wait your time. And Tom Pidcock, although they'll nurse him, and he's clearly ready for this, you know, to go 250, 260 odd kilometres in Amstel Gold and get pipped by Wout van Aert in a sprint, who's a Tour de France sprinter as well as many other things, is I wouldn't underestimate just how big a performance that was. And he's riding with a maturity that I've not seen the like of in a young rider for a long time.
You know, I think that finish and the closeness of the finish sums up an awful lot about racing right now and cycling right now. And we've maybe said it for a few years in terms of the youth that's coming through. But I feel like we're in such an exciting time in cycling right now. And the closeness of those two and the calibre of the two of them. Wout van Aert excites me so much.
It was good for Dutch cycling, wasn't it?
Well, he's Belgian. Yeah, but for the Jumbo,
they almost consider him Dutch.
They do. They do. They very much adopt him.
And
he's got Dutch heritage as well, I think. He's not far from the border. But he excites me anyway. His style of racing excites me. But there are lots of them like that. And I love seeing these guys coming from cyclocross. And I tweeted something about Pidcock when he won Brabantse Appeal that I think some people sort of misunderstood, but I was saying it was almost remarkable that that was his first professional win. And some people were taking that as if to say that he should have won already by now. What I meant was, I feel like we've known about Pidcock's talents for such a long time. And obviously he won the Baby Giro, as we call it, last year, but he's got such huge potential that he's delivered on already. I was just surprised that that was his first win, because I feel like it was confirmation of what we knew already, that he's a supreme talent.
Yeah. Well, we don't know what his potential is. I think he could win the Tour de France one day. Mm. I really do.
Talking about a man who has won the Tour de France, Pogacar outsprinting Alaphilippe to the line at Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
I mean, we're blessed with such great riders at the moment, young riders.
Yeah.
You know, we've been so used over the years to talk about the Nibalis of this world and that, and, you know, Gilbert and these guys, but it's this generation have just come through a lot earlier now, and it's brilliant to watch. But yeah, Pogacar, I mean, that certainly wasn't a fluke in the pan. We saw what he did at the Vuelta the year before when he was winning the mountain stages there. Tour de France winning Liège-Bastogne-Liège. It happened last year due to Alaphilippe's sort of kind of disqualification and salute, wasn't it, when Primoz won. But obviously, Primoz didn't win the Tour de France, but he was up there in the Tour. And it's great to see now, with the calendar back where it should be, a Tour de France winner up there early season, competing in the classics.
And one more for you. Casper Asgreen outpowering Mathieu van der Poel to the line at the Tour of Flanders. Again, certainly not one that I predicted.
And Mathieu is probably the disappointment for me this spring. Because that Tirreno stage that he won, where he just dominated, it looked like, God, this guy's going to... And I feel a little bit sorry for him, really, because we expect so much from him, don't we? That when he gets second in the Tour of Flanders, it's, I tell you, he got second in the Tour of Flanders. It's a shame, really. I don't know what Dutch cycling made of it today in the newspapers.
Yeah, huge disappointment.
Really,
absolutely. But the thing
is... His father was quite critical of him, wasn't he? Was that just misreported in the press about...
I missed that. Adri
was saying that he's not completely happy with his riding style. He's riding too aggressively and leaves himself too much work to do. And I heard that through English commentary, but that might have been misreported.
Yeah, I'll have to check out the original. But you say that he's been disappointing, but it's meant that it's been really exciting to watch, hasn't it? Because whenever the two of them went solo and dropped, not solo, duo, but dropped Wout van Aert, my heart sank a little bit. I thought, oh, here we go, Van der Poel. I don't need to watch the rest of this race. There is no way Casper Asgreen can get the better of him. And certainly not if it comes down to a sprint, which it did. And I just thought it was so impressive from Asgreen to have that confidence and to wait and to not try to attack too early, to wait and to try to beat Van der Poel in a sprint and to manage it was really quite spectacular.
I think that stems from the team and Lefebvre and Wilfried Peters and these guys. That team, I don't know, they've won that race, was it something, I think something like 17 times since its formation back in post-Mapai, which was Domo. Yeah, it's quite something. And that running, that sort of 5K running, with the likes of Wilfried Peters and Tom Steele's behind, they would have been in his ear. And if anything, the pressure was on Van der Poel, wasn't it?
Again. Yeah.
So Casper was incredible. First Danish winner since Rolf Sørensen in 1997.
One more fast man to mention, Mark Cavendish. Four stages at the Tour of Turkey. I know we were all delighted.
And we sat here last year, didn't we, with him in tears at Gent-Wevelgem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've been one of his big cheerleaders, Bradley, and you're
I think it's great. I sent him a message saying, I sent him and Peter a message saying, back where he should be with a smile on his face. Yeah, and it's his rightful position, you know. And if he does nothing else for the rest of the season, he's proved he can win again.
Absolutely, and that's what he needed to do. And I think that's what. I mean, I wrote a column in Metro newspaper about it, where I just feel like we should have been celebrating Mark Cavendish long before now, and it sounds ridiculous to say because it's not like his achievements have gone unnoted. But I feel like because of the way that he hasn't been winning, I guess, There's been a lot of talk of he's a feared force and all the rest of it. And I love that now we've got the chance to celebrate his wins and appreciate his greatness as he's still in it.
He looks happy again now.
Yeah.
And there's a new spring in his step. And you can tell that by his Instagram videos and the stories he does.
I was thinking that earlier, actually. Yeah.
And he just looks a happy soul. And I think that stems again from the team he's back in. I don't think the team was right for him the last few years. Mm. And he looks back at home.
Mm. I've got to ask you both, can we see him at the tour?
I really hope so. And I hope that it carries on. Him and Sam have been working well together, and I think he'll be great to have at the tour. Not necessarily as that last lead out man, because there's a size difference between the two of them as to whether he can get enough protection, Sam. But imagine Cav and Sam rooming together and just talking all the time about, where to pick up points and reading through that race book. He would be so useful, and I would take him from that point of view, just from that mentor Sam for the 3 weeks.
I don't know how that decision making process goes on to Koenig Quickstep, but you would imagine that it should depend on Sam, really, because he's got a green jersey to defend. He's shown in Algarve just how phenomenally strong he is, and leading from the front for so long in a sprint. So I think it should depend on him. I would take him too, though, and I just think amazing PR for the team. If they're all aligned, then what an amazing sprint you've got. And also, what a great hand to be able to play. Everyone will, of course, be watching Bennett. Cavendish wouldn't be that much of a surprise, but, you've got, it always helps in a sprint to not necessarily know which man you're going to mark,
Yeah.
I'd love to see it.
Before the tour, though, the 104th Giro d'Italia, a massive 3,450 kilometres over 21 stages, brief dips into Slovenia and Switzerland. Before we get into today's stage, the opening time trial, I wanted to pick out a couple of stages just looking forwards that are really going to make a difference, starting with perhaps stage 11 and a bit of Strada Bianchi.
Yeah, we did that in 2010. I think it's been in a couple of times since then, hasn't it? It's going to be unpredictable. It's tough. It's great to watch. There'll be selection of choice of wheels and bikes to use, and obviously the weather conditions. It adds that spice to the race, and it's becoming part and parcel of the Giro a bit now. I think that Strada Bianchi, it was only, I think the race started in 2009, didn't it? The Strada Bianchi race. It's becoming this the course of the White Roads, they call it, and it's really sort of becoming part of the fabric of Italian cycling again now, like it used to be historically when Fausto Coppi and all these guys used to ride up the hills, which were then white roads. A bit like, the sort of rejuvenation of the cobbled stage in the Tour de France every couple of years. Mm. It's becoming more and more kind of, the heritage of cycling within France or Italy, that Strada Bianchi is now part of cycling. It's a historical race, and they're integrating it into their grand tours now, which is great to see. A bit like in the Vuelta's version of it is, the kind of the steep climb at the end of the race that they always put Hugh won on last year. The Angliru was the climb.
Angliru is one of the riders called it. Yeah.
Where I lost the jersey with Chris Froome. That's becoming sort of part of the fabric of the race.
I was going to say they were brown roads when you did it in 2010. It was a mud slick, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And I went hunger flat that day, 2Ks ago, and lost about 3 minutes.
So I wanted to ask you that earlier. We were talking about it in the show. Yeah. Do you think that hunger flat was anything to do with the fact that it was the gravel, or was it just one of those things that
it
happened?
It was raining most of the second part of the stage, and I had a jacket, cape on. I think it was quite cold. I had long-fingered gloves, neoprene gloves. And it was just, the racing was just on, and your heads were down, and we were left and right. There was crashes. It was sliding through sand. You just physically didn't have time to eat.
Yeah.
Lift your rain jacket up and put your hands in your bag and find. And it was just, it was like that. A bit like Paris-Roubaix. You forget to eat sometimes. Mm. Yeah.
Stage 14, the hellish arms of the Zonkalan, and the first time that we will see that side of the mountain again, Brad, since
2003. I raced up it with Marco Pantani, Gilberto Simoni, Gazzelli. There was it was an incredible, amazing day. I mean, I all I remember about that day, my only memories of it, was it gets really steep in the final section. It goes off onto a service road which goes up to the ski lifts. So we've got the paved road on the other side, which we've been used to seeing the last few years. But this side, it's normal road, and then it goes off onto a service road, if it's still the same, which goes up to, basically, it's a service road to the motor or the engine room of the ski lift that brings you back down. So it's
that,
pretty...
That tells you something.
So when they build a service road, quite often, it's not a normal road. It just goes straight up the quickest way.
Yeah. One of my favourite stages to cover. I absolutely love the Zonkalan, and you can't cover it without taking those ski lifts, you know. And I just think that always gives me goosebumps when I'm at a stage where to get to the summit, you can't even walk it. There's no point in walking it. You've got to get the chairlift up. That just fills me with awe every time as to what you guys go through.
And actually, talking of high mountain stages, the Giro is, as ever, back heavy in terms of vertical kilometres. 4,800 metres of climbing on the menu for the penultimate stage.
Yeah.
An absolute epic to finish. I mean, are we expecting it to come down to the final time trial, or are we expecting the GC men to have made their mark before then?
I think they'd have made a big difference by then. If the stages are as hard as we're anticipating, I think it's going to be big time gaps by then. And I don't think it's going to be as close as last year. What do you think, Ola?
Well, last year was so phenomenally close. I think it'll be very difficult to come down to that again. But the thing is, you have such a match of riders, and it just depends, obviously, on how they get through the first 2 weeks anyway. But when you look at the odds for the riders who are up there, you've got like Simon Yates and Egan Bernal are the joint top favourites, then Remco Evenepoel. And then you've got the likes of Vlasov, Sivakov, Hugh Carthy. And to me, they're all much of a muchness, really. And then, of course, Almeida and Hindley. Almeida maybe not so strong in the third week. But I feel like we've got a really good match of riders. And after today's stage, they're all in and around the same area, which, you know, stage one is a long, long way off. But I would really hope to see a proper battle. I mean, to be honest, as long as it gets too deep into that third week, it doesn't really matter to me if the time trial is almost decided, because we know that anything can happen on a time trial if it's a wet day, for example. But as long as we can get all those big contenders fighting deep into the mountains, that just gets you in the gut, doesn't it?
I mean, we say anything can happen, but today ended up being, I should say, a very predictable time trial in one sense. And
you say predictable. Bradley was the only one who got the prediction right.
In another, it was an absolutely explosive way to start a grand tour, 8.6 kilometres around Turin. Jumbo-Visma really lit it up before Filippo Ganna. Yeah. Brad, your pick.
And, Filippo, was he doing 8 minutes 40 something? I mean, so it was 8.6 kilometres. He's done it in 8 minutes 40. It shows you the speed.
8.47.
Yeah, it shows you the speeds they were travelling.
Yeah.
Close to 60 kilometres an hour the whole way round. And he was 10 seconds as well to win by at those speeds. It's quite something. But, yeah, I mean, Vlasov, I mean, there was a few riders that did some fantastic, you know, performances. Riders that were off the pace as well. But the one for me as well is Remco Evenepoel, 7th today.
7th today, 19 seconds off the pace.
9 months, no racing, broken femur, broken pelvis.
First Grand Tour.
First Grand Tour.
First race of the season.
Still 21 years of age, is he? 22 now?
20? No, he's still 21, I think.
21.
Yeah. So last person to take on a Grand Tour without any competitive racing in their legs was, and Dylan Groenewegen's doing the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Tom Dumoulin, wasn't it?
I think it was David Miller in 2006, after coming back from his
ban. Of course it was,
taking on the tour.
And that was 2 years away, wasn't it, Dave?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What I'm really glad about today is that everyone stayed upright, that we still have a battle. What I get really disappointed by is the end of day one, when one of the big contenders or two of the big contenders crash out. Even if they continue racing, you just know those injuries are going to niggle. So I'm really glad that we've got a full complement of contenders going into stage two. But I tell you what, Jumbo-Visma, truly. I mean, you look at, I know Eduardo Affino, second, which was phenomenal, but Tobias Foss as well. I think we've really got to watch out for him. Tour de l'Avenir winner. He was fifth in the opening time trial last year. I kicked myself for not mentioning him in the pre-show, but he's a really mature, grounded rider, and I'm really excited to see what he's going to do. Jumbo-Visma, 3 riders in the top 10 today, and they don't even have their A team here. So,
well, I was saying to Dan Lloyd before when we were watching the live coverage, Jumbo-Visma have got very much a B team here, really.
Compared to what they're going to take to the tour. Yeah.
And yet, like you say, Ola, Affini and Foss at 10 seconds and then 13 seconds, two
Affini,
of the top three.
Not Affino.
Sorry, I didn't deliberately pick you up on that. You're right. Sorry, I wasn't nitpicking, I promise.
No, you should be. You should be correcting me. It's good. It's good. But it just goes to show we weren't expecting him up there today. I hadn't even looked at...
And João Almeida, I mean, I think he'll be happiest of the GC men in at 4 on 17 seconds. Beating Cavagna.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's learned a lot from last year. I mean, we were talking about him nearly winning the thing last year.
Yeah.
I mean, he was only a first-year professional last year, wasn't he? Second-year professional. Second-year pro. And I think he'll be up there a lot this year. I think he'll be on the podium. I think he'll be battling with Remco, obviously, for that GC. But
well, they've got joint leadership, haven't they?
Yeah. It's going to be such a great race. It's so hard to call at this stage. You know? Yeah, it really is.
So I just want to dwell on Cavagna there for a second too, because you know, I think we were looking at the course today thinking that it probably suited Ganna better, but Cavagna at the Tour de Romandie has shown that Ganna is beatable, even though very, very different scenario when it's cold, when it's wet, particularly that final time trial at Romandie when you've got a week's racing in your legs. And Ganna's just shown today, you know, a flat course when he's had a week's rest, just how much better he can be when the conditions are right.
I said earlier it was it's quite a contradiction in it that it's a good marker for some riders, it's not a good marker for others. For someone like Vincenzo Nibali, he could win the thing or he could finish last and he'll have no reflection on how he does or how he's going for the 3 weeks. Someone like Romain Bardet, I think it's more quite a reflection on him to see where he's at for that product. And I think, I don't know, I'm not trying to work out if that's more of a mental or a physical thing, but lots of riders are really affected by the performance in the prologue time trial mentally. They overthink things. They overthink, oh, am I going well? They'll scan the result sheets in the evening and see where they are in comparison to the riders they thought they should be around. And I get the sense that Bardet's kind of like that a little bit, kind of over, especially as he's been off the ball for a couple of years now.
He finished 52 seconds down today.
Yeah.
What do you expect from him?
I'd love to see him up there again. I think he's a great rider. I think he's a good lad. He's just, I don't know, he almost outstayed his welcome at La Mondiale for a few years. You know, the French, they can get into a bit of a rut there, a bit like Pinot has done. You know, sometimes it's good to get out of the French teams and almost...
And out of the Tour de France as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it's good to see him here, actually. Pinot had some of his better performances at the Giro, didn't he?
Yeah, it's a shame not to see him here.
Yeah, he's got a bad back.
Yeah.
He's always got a bad back, isn't he?
What?
Pino.
Yeah, well, is he, what are we expecting from him? Is he finished?
Too much foam roller in, I think.
I hope he's not done. I love him
I like him.
Much.
I like
he's
him.
Beautiful to watch. He's beautiful and he's tragic and he's
he's
emotional.
He's a romantic rider, isn't he?
Oh, he's a romantic rider and he tugs at your heart. And even watching him cry just fills my heart. I love him. I love him.
I wasn't expecting this sort of soliloquy. this is excellent.
And he's not even riding.
You don't really get this depth of feeling sometimes.
No, it's a bit like Jean-Michel Pépin. It reminds me.
Brad, how do you prepare as a GC man, going back to 2010 for you?
Yeah, I mean, it depends.
How do you prepare
for
an opening stage like this, a short time trial? You won it for Team Sky in 2010, taking the pink jersey, your first Grand Tour for Sky. I mean, how do you approach it, first of all, like I asked? And second, was the pressure on you particularly?
Yeah, the pressure was on me because I was a World Olympic Pursuit champion and, you know, I was time trialing was my thing. So as well as going for GC, I had the pressure of I could win the opening stage and replicate what Brad McGee did and the like, you know, Chris Boardman. But with the element of going for GC as well. So it's a very difficult one. I had to compromise the GC really in the days before and the week before in focusing specifically on the team and the individual time trial. And that would include, you know, sort of 6 days out, a full-on dress rehearsal, where 3 days before that dress rehearsal, you freshened up to the extent like a track event, which means that for sort of 9 or 10 days going into the Grand Tour, you were not doing any... sort of long rides and stuff because it was all about that, and that affects you then 2 or 3 weeks into the race. Whereas when I won the tour, funny enough, I didn't do any preparation for the prologue time trial. It was all about the tour, and I still got second. So but back then we were still very much in a track mindset coming off of British Cycling. Whereas, as I say, if you're going for GC, you know, you'll still be doing like a 4 or 5 hour ride on the Wednesday before the prologue on the Saturday. Someone like Vincenzo Nibali would have done 2 hours this morning before the prologue, probably done an hour afterwards because he's in mode for that. Whereas Ganna or myself, when I won the prologue, was literally 20 minutes on the rollers in the morning, much like a track event, 20 minute warm up and out the door and explode. Probably no warm down either if you win because you get straight to the podium and the relief and everything. So the next day you're quite drained emotionally. Mm-hmm. It's a big mental challenge and a big mental effort that you put in for a prologue day. Because the mental energy you exert and burn is probably just as important as the physical energy. And that's why the likes of Nibali and that went off quite early in the day today. They just take it in their stride and get on with it. You know, a 40-second loss or a 50-second loss to someone like Ganna is not going to end up, you know, huge in 3 weeks' time.
What else might have jaded you the following day after that podium celebration?
Well, you have a few drinks in the evening, celebrate. Yeah. Did you? I mean, I got a Magnum and I just remember trying to be funny.
Magnum of champagne, not
yeah,
the ice cream.
Yeah, I tried to drink it on the podium. The whole thing.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
How much did you get through?
The whole thing.
Did you? You didn't. You didn't.
I didn't. I did afterwards. Yeah.
Because it's usually one glass in the evening.
Yeah, and it was a huge relief to win that. You know, take the first Grand Tour jersey and the first Grand Tour for Sky.
With all of that pressure around that team,
it was
as well,
my best,
you guys
one of my best executed performances with my worst form.
Mm.
I won by 2 seconds from Brent Bookwater. Yeah. And Cav never let me forget that. Mom, he goes, "You had to win that, lad, because imagine if you got beat by Brent Bookwater." Poor Brent. Yeah, he's a really nice lad, but it wasn't
still
like,
riding.
It wasn't beating,
yeah, exactly.
But at
yeah.
the time, like, what his point was, it wasn't like beating Cancellara.
Yeah.
It was. You know,
who else? So Blanc,
no one's ever heard of at the time, which was what Cav's words were.
Cadell Evans to complete the podium that day. I'm going from memory.
I think
here.
It was. Yeah. So and that was Delvino. Like 2 seconds, 3 seconds. It wasn't like 10 seconds over.
Yeah.
You know, so that shows you how bad form I was in.
Yeah. All right. More from the Bradley Wiggins Show after this. Zwift is the world's training playground, Brad, where fun takes you further, recreating the outdoor feel of riding on an indoor trainer. Something you can get on board with, I think.
It does, yeah. And Zwift have done it very well. And they're now the leaders, aren't they, in that world? And they've got the likes of Geraint Thomas on board. And, you know, probably can't get...
Your old mate, yeah.
Yeah, and it's... You know, they did some involvement with Team Wiggins a few years ago. We joined in one of their shops, Pinarello shop races one night, and my son uses it. I watch him during the winter months. It's something I wish I'd had when I was 15, definitely just to, from a safety point of view, when you didn't want to let your kids out on the road in the dark.
And anyone can use it. So, you don't have to be G, you don't have to be a pro. You can train with thousands of real people.
Yeah. Like, you can train with anyone. You can ride with anyone from the world of pro cycling or from your workplace or school, whatever age you are.
Brad, like you say, most of the pros on the World Tour train on Zwift.
Yeah, hop on anytime, heart pumping, intense cycling, join group rides, events and worldwide races.
Zwift has 9 worlds too, including the stunning Paris and France maps. They've recreated Tour de France stages, which gives everyone a chance to experience them. You don't have to have been Bradley Wiggins to experience what it's like to ride at the Tour de France. You can hit your kilometres with virtual dinosaurs, raging waterfalls. You can be inside a volcano, James Bond-esque, a wide open California desert. Plus, you can tour London landmarks.
All you need is a bike, trainer, and Zwift app.
You can get a free 7-day trial, Brad, no strings attached, at Zwift.com. Welcome back to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, sponsored by Zwift, where fun is fast.
Unless you've got no brakes.
Brad Orla. I'd like to dwell.
And it's terrifying.
I'd like to dwell for a moment on Filippo Ganna. Already 5 stages in his Giro d'Italia career, having won 4 last year, the 3 time trials, of course. But he also showed that he can win road stages too with that breakaway, somewhat unexpected at the time. He's only 24. Perhaps it's a bit early to ask this question, but could he beat... Does he have the potential to beat Mario Cipollini's all-time record of 42?
He does. I mean, he'll have
We're doing
to do
a calf on him, aren't we, though? We're going to have him cursed now forevermore.
Chasing Merckx's
record. It doesn't
matter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's not a sprinter. Cipollini was in an era where, you know, it was predominantly an Italian race with a couple of wild cards from other countries.
And it was the first era of the sprint
train.
And
he ruled the peloton. Yeah. I mean, I remember doing the 2003, we were in Sicily on stage 2. We were going up this mountain, I think Vesuvio or somewhere like that, down the other side. And it was guaranteed to be a sprint if no one attacked up the climb. He went to the front with Mario Scirea and Bramati, and they just sat up like that across the road, put their arms in the air and said, no one attack. We rode up this thing for an hour down the other side and Cipollini won. Actually, Cipollini didn't win, Pataki won. That wouldn't happen now, you know, and Chipper, that was sort of the mafia and dominated the race, and it's a different era. So in some ways, if Ganna does it, that's quite some achievement. And is he going to move on to things like the Tour de France and, you know, will the Giro be his priority? Whereas back then, you know, with Acqua Saponi, Mercatone Uno and all that, that was their priority. That's where they made their bread and butter, and that's where the sponsors, it was their world championship.
Apparently, before the Zonkalan that year, 2003, Cipollini didn't make it up the Zonkalan. He got off his bike as he was wont to do.
Yeah, he crashed the day before, I think, in a rain.
Coming into the finish.
Yeah.
Apparently, Cippo had a mountain bike waiting for him at the bottom of the Zonkalan.
Really?
Is this true?
Was you there?
Well, I wasn't there. No, yeah, I wasn't there.
That's why I was a young 7-year-old boy.
All the best stories are the ones that are completely unsourced.
Yeah, I don't know actually on that. Yeah. No, I remember when he did retire in 2005. He turned up at the Giro and wanted to go off last man in the prologue, which he did. Like after the last rider went, he went off in a pink suit and rode down waving to the crowd. It was his retirement lap of honour.
I love how Cipollini is.
Like, doing what he's doing.
There's no one else like him. Like, follow him on Instagram. I'm sure you both do. And his posts could not be from anyone else. I just love how much he encapsulates himself.
Yeah.
You know, so I think even if Ghana goes on to even touch his record, he won't be posting topless selfies on Instagram in his 50s looking like that, you know?
You know Mario Profondi, Mario.
Yeah.
So Mario was at Saico, the team back then when Cipollini was riding. So Mario started his, you know, swan-yearing career at Saico when Cipollini was there, I think, or Liquigas, wherever Mario was working. And Cipollini would insist on having this specific marmalade from Tuscany every day, a jar of marmalade that his swan-year had to get for him. He had his own swan-year. It had to be an unopened one every day, brand new. One day someone had opened his marmalade and apparently he came in and Mario said, "My God, Brad," he picked the marmalade up, he threw this thing across the restaurant, smash, everybody swearing, cuts off 5 figure marks. And the way he tells this story, but Mario apparently was really volatile and, you know, he could, like, unpredictable, could turn up at breakfast dressed as a mushroom, things like that.
Oh, Bradley.
No, he was volatile.
Like, you had a reputation when you were racing. I wish you had stories to match that. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I have got some great ones.
Yeah, I know.
I told you to piss off one day.
one day, many times. But you didn't do it dressed as a mushroom. That's the point.
There you go.
Podcast Pete tells me that the mountain bike story for Cipollini is 100% accurate. And apparently,
how does Podcast Pete know?
It was a protest. Podcast, it was a protest against the barbarity of the stage. But he's spoken about it, is how Pete knows. So Cipollini.
The mushroom one's better anyway.
Don't believe a word he says. This is a man who put a bet on the Norwegian team to win the curling world championship. <Don't forget.
laughs> Little plug for you before we go on.
Peanuts.
Cipollini's story is the subject of our latest Recycle podcast from Eurosport, an epic two-parter that takes in all the flair, flamboyance, as Ola mentioned, and drama. From Chippo's colourful career, available now wherever you get your podcasts. Brad, one for you. You'll be downloading.
I certainly will be.
Yeah. A couple of the favourites. Talking of the big names, a couple of the favourites that we haven't yet mentioned for this year's Giro. Simon Yates. Ola, where do you see Yates in terms of where he's at now, having been so dominant at the Tour of the Alps? He's 28 years old. He's out and out leader for Bike Exchange. He's had a curious relationship with the Giro so far, having led for 13 stages in 2018, cracked in the final week. We saw that epic ride from Froome, of course, an underwhelming eighth place in 2019. And then he exited the race early last year because of testing positive for COVID. Yeah.
At this stage, he's my favourite. Now that comes with the caveat that there are so many question marks over so many other people. So Egan Bernal, we've no idea what his back is like. And he hasn't ridden a full Grand Tour since the Tour de France that he won 2019. 2 years. Remco Evenepoel, we've got absolutely no idea. And then I think the others are sort of lumped together, really. So for me, Yates is a favourite. His form at the Tour of the Alps, everybody has said it, but his dominance in Stage 2 was 2018 Giro d'Italia riding vintage. He was phenomenal. And I think that his experience and history with this race can only stand him in good stead. He's not going to be coming in all cocky, thinking that he can do it because he nearly did in 2018. He has grown into his confidence, though, and he's not afraid of saying anymore that he's favourite. We saw that last year. He's not going to be thrown by disappointment because he has been disappointed here. He's got a phenomenal team around him. He's got Matt White in charge as well, who knows what he's doing and knows Yates so well. For me, given the form that he's had, given his age, actually, and we talk a lot about the young ones coming through, but given his age and experience, Simon Yates, for me, is the favourite right now.
You've spoken to Whitey?
I spoke to him sporadically through the winter. They were... Whitey's is still as passionate as he was when I was racing at Garmin.
Where does he get that energy? He is, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he just loves it, you know. And every time he did message me, he'd say, you know, look, oh, I can't wait, mate. Just can't wait for it, you know. It's like, oh, we've got 3 months yet, mate. You know, so it's like, he's just, no, I can't wait to get mate. Get on the bike, you know. He just oozes. And I think that rubs off on those guys. And he's brilliant for Simon. Simon's got unfinished business here. I think he's... I just love his how cool and calm and collected he is. Nothing phases him. You know, he could have a bad performance one day, he'll get up the next and have another go. And I really do hope, I'd love to see him win it. I really think he deserves it. And obviously to add to his Vuelta, because he was so dominant 3 years ago now, you know, and but for, it's hard to say, but for an amazing and magnificent Chris Froome on the last day, would he have cracked under that pressure? Or they've just sort of, you know, it's so
well, I think he went so deep every day, didn't he? It was When the crack came, and it's easy in hindsight, but it was all, it felt inevitable.
Yeah,
because he did go so deep. But it, but to me, still, it's some of the most magnificent Grand Tour racing I've ever
it
seen.
Was amazing.
I loved how he got on it every single day and pushed as hard as he could.
But the
every
Giro's
day,
done that, hasn't it? If you remember, Kruijswijk hitting on the Garvia when Nibali came back from 3 minutes down. Of course, Primoz 2 years ago with the whole Urine stop with the wheel change, and it's always good. It's always brilliant. Tao last year, yeah.
Back to Simon Yates briefly. The last person, the last rider to win a pre-Giro stage race and then go on to win the Giro itself. So obviously Yates has won the Tour of the Alps, formerly the Giro del Trentino, which might give you a little clue. You rode this race in 2013.
Yeah.
Vincenzo Nibali.
He won it, yeah.
He won it. Yeah. He also won Tirreno. And I mean, does that tell you something? We don't really know where Nibali
is. What it tells
you
is he won the Giro. Right.
No. But you don't have to be coming into it on red hot form. I mean,
I don't know.
At,
I would say sometimes you do, a bit different to the Tour. The only one who hasn't is probably Chris Froome the last time when he came in and rode himself in. But someone like Chris is the only person who could do that. How magnificent he is as an athlete. Someone like Simon, I think he'll want to be on it straight away. And that punchy riding style and that, you know, I think he really is.
Because this is what I always find really interesting, having never been a bike rider, never been a bike racer, I should say. This whole concept of not coming in red hot and coming in undercooked, as everybody likes to say.
I was just thinking of you riding around bloody Buckingham Palace that time on the bike.
Oh, Brad, don't. You don't get pictures of that the last time.
We'll have to get you both to post these on your social channels so we can see exactly what Brad's
talking
about.
This is for the Team Sky launch in 2000. It was the very start of 2010.
It was -5, wasn't it?
It was minus five. I didn't even have a bike at the time, so I had no Lycra. I remember borrowing a friend's husband's helmet.
You looked like a competition
helmet.
Winner, didn't you?
I did. I wore like high street ballet pumps. I dressed all in black because I hoped that then that would make me inconspicuous. I wore a puffer jacket, a grey puffer jacket. And I remember riding down the Mall, interviewing Bradley live on Sky News on the Mall, and thinking, I think I've pulled this off. I think nobody's noticed.
It definitely won't come back to haunt you.
And then Bradley dug out a picture of it at the dinner table of the Tour de France 2 years ago. Oh, my life.
That was 11
years
ago.
That was a vintage look. What were we saying? I've never been a bike racer. Anyway, that was it.
Fascinating.
We were on Vincenzo Nibali.
Yeah, well, we were on this concept of being undercooked, which I don't even like the concept of it. I think it's such a cliche. But yeah. You saying that you don't need to come into the Giro d'Italia building into form. What is all that building into form? I mean, I get it that the third week is harder, but surely you come into the race in as good a form as you can be.
You create workload and create damage, you create fatigue, and then you back off and you recruit and you neurally recruit and everything in your muscles and all the work you've done. So to recruit the gains from training, you have to rest. Once you do that, then you hit top form. Ideally, that's the sort of general thesis of kind of...
And how long can you maintain that top form for, arguably?
Well, 3 weeks, yeah. I mean, as long as you keep feathering it. But we, over the years, particularly Chris Froome would train into the Giro and not back off and recruit and kind of recover, because once you do that, so keep an element of fatigue, which sounds strange, isn't it? It's sort of an underlying residual fatigue that you then... So you basically ride at sort of 90%, 85% for the whole thing, rather than starting at 100 and... The fresher you are, the more damage you can do. So you go too deep into reserves because you're too fresh, you then have a massive sort of payback for that, really. So that's kind of the sort of simplest way of trying to explain it. And to win a prologue, you have to recruit every little last watt of energy. So you have to back off and be as fresh as possible. Now, when you do back off, lots of riders feel quite blocked or don't feel good because they've not opened up enough. But there's a disproportionality as how you feel and how you go. Feel's got nothing to do with it. You could win the race. No one ever wins a race as I felt great in a prologue anyway. It was the hurts and it's the worst thing experience you ever go through, particularly in a pursuit or something. But you look at the numbers afterwards, it's like, God, I did a PB. it's just got, you know, you can't correlate it with how you feel. And that's kind of what they've worked through in Grand Tours, particularly at Sky under Tim Kerrison, is this kind of training and racing under fatigue, but backing off enough, backing off too much that you get a massive sort of, it's like pulling an elastic band with training and then letting go with it and seeing how much form you get the other side.
One more for you. We mentioned him briefly earlier, Hugh Carthy.
Yeah.
His form has not been brilliant. But
it wasn't great going into the Volta last year.
And it's not been bad.
He's performed well at the Basque Country, for example.
Well, let's see in 3 weeks' time. I think he's going to be a big player in this race.
I'd like to mention the sprinters too, and specifically Dylan Groenewegen, back after his 9-month ban for his actions in the sprint at the Tour of Poland that, of course, famously caused Fabio Jakobsen's horror crash. Groenewegen has said he's here to win a stage. We've talked briefly about how strong Jumbo-Visma are looking. Are they in for a bit of both? Are they in for GC as well as in for Groenewegen in the sprints? With what we've established is probably their B team. Do they have the capacity to do that?
Well, they'll have a go. I mean, they might just designate one or two riders to Dylan, but I think a lot of it will depend on Dylan, really. He'll want to feel his legs and see how he's sort of... I guess they won't want to put too much pressure on him, will they? Because until he gets into that sort of boiling pan tomorrow in that last 5-10K, how he's going to feel, it might be a very strange experience for him.
They've had to treat this one really carefully.
They've looked after him well, though, haven't they?
They seem to have looked after him well. Yeah, and I've spoken to Richard Plucher, the team manager, an awful lot about this, actually, over the last year. And he has said how, you know, I asked him, how do you look after Groenewegen during all of this? Because it's been a terrible time for him. And I don't apologise for being sympathetic, because what happened in the Tour of Poland was not much worse than what happens in a lot of sprints. The consequences, to my mind, were much more down to the race organisers than anything else. But he's had death threats and he's had endless abuse. And Plucher said, all we can do is be there for him and let him know that we're there for him. We can't impose ourselves upon him to take any help, but he knows that he's got our backing. And I guess the fact that bringing him back to the Giro d'Italia as soon as he can come back to racing is evidence of the fact that they are supporting him. I don't think they would bring him here unless they believed he could win a sprint and unless they wanted him to win a sprint. And if they want him to win a sprint, they're going to work for him. The thing is, sprint trains aren't what they used to be. They're not as necessary as they used to be. And Groenewegen's a kind of sprinter, like most top sprinters, who can jump on the back of anyone else's train and take a win. I think it's going to be brilliant for him if he does. And I think just being able to talk about a win rather than all of this other stuff that's been happening will be really positive for him. And Bradley, you mentioned in the show earlier how he's gone through so much in terms of he's had a premature baby and there's been an awful lot of uncertainty there. I can't imagine the psychological journey that he's been on in the last year. And for that alone, I really, really hope to see him winning. You know, just as another human being who's been through an awful lot and not all of it his fault.
Yeah, and he's still having to ask her questions about it, isn't he? Yeah. And he's still sort of almost sort of tarnished a little bit as not the victim in all this. I mean, it's just a tragic circumstances that arose. And, they're both victims in my eyes for different reasons. And obviously there's still this sort of element of controversy about who's said sorry to who. They've both gone through very, very different things. And you just don't know what's going on in their heads as to maybe the resentment each one would have for their own reasons for each other. And it can't be forced upon them that he said, sorry, yeah. It's like, well, it's only 9 months. You have no idea what they've gone through psychologically, mental health-wise. They're still having to talk about it and justify themselves, you know, a little bit.
They were supposed to have had a private meeting this week. That turned out not to be so private after Groenewegen came out and spoke about it publicly. And Jakobsen's reaction has been to counter that and say Groenewegen hasn't offered a personal apology or taken responsibility for his actions. And has then gone on to say the content of this meeting was supposed to stay confidential between the two of us and our legal teams.
They have the same agent, or at least they certainly did last year, and I think they still do. So that's an interesting dynamic. But, you know, I wonder, you know, did the Tour of Poland ever apologise? I haven't seen it.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Dylan will have his own reasons. He may not feel that he has to take responsibility for
and
his actions.
And it could be legal reasons. You know, if he offers a personal apology, then that make him legally culpable?
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's really difficult. If there are legal proceedings ongoing, then,
yeah,
you know, it's much more difficult to admit that you've taken responsibility for something if it's got legal repercussions. He might be personally sorry.
And responsibility for what? You know, he's not saying sorry that what happened to Jakobsen from a physical point of view. Of course, we don't need to validate that someone's going to say sorry for that because it was horrendous. But whether he's being forced into a position that he has to say, I purposely swerved across the road and I'm sorry for that. There's an apology in that there might not be an admittance from his point of view that was just sprinting. I'm not going to apologize for something. It's like saying, well, you stabbed me with a knife and you intended to do that. Well, I didn't intend to do it, but I can't. If I apologize, I'm almost admitting that I did it on purpose.
I think,
and there's lots of things that we don't know about, you know, and it's getting reported back through the media and stuff. It's very complicated, and I find it funny that it took this long for this week to have a personal meeting.
Especially, like I say, because they do have the same agent.
And I think that they were preempting some sort of press that they were going to get asked these questions on the Giro, but they might not be ready for that individually with what they've been through.
I just think it's a huge, huge, huge shame, that still the race organisers have not come out and said that this was wrong, we were wrong, and this is what we're going to do to make sprinting safer in the future, because it wasn't just the barriers that weren't tied down, even though they're claiming they were. I mean, what force you'd need to go through those to be able to untie them. But a downhill sprint, we don't need it. We do not need the extra element of danger. Sprinting is dangerous enough, and that is what we love about it. It's what the riders love about it. It's what attracts sprinters to it. We don't need to add in extra bits and pieces here and there. We need to make sure that sprints are safe so that riders can go at their top speed. We can get the best racing we can possibly imagine, and they know if anything happens that their welfare is being protected. And if that's not the case, then that's a shame. And I don't mean it's a pity. I mean, it's a shame. It's a shame on the race.
Hopefully we will see a safe sprint tomorrow, stage two, 179 kilometres into Navarra. First chance in the race for the sprinters, if not Groenewegen tomorrow. Or in fact, maybe you are back in Groenewegen tomorrow. Who's your pick?
I'd love to see Groenewegen win. I think it'd be a great return. It might be a big ask. But I'm going to say that Gaviria... Another man on the comeback.
Yeah. All right. Under the radar. Yeah. I like that. Orla?
It depends on the weather conditions. If there's anything of a headwind, I go for Caleb Ewan. I'm going to go big, though. I'm going to go Groenewegen on his first day back. I'm going to... Jumbo-Visma are going to be buoyed tonight, you know, after their performance today. They're going to be... It's going to be a good atmosphere in their team hotel tonight. And I think they'll want to do everything possible to get him to the line first tomorrow. So
that's a lot of pressure on him, though, isn't it? Sitting there going, hey, it's my first race back and I have to...
but he's not going to want to just sidle into this, is he? You know, he'll know as well. That's how he gets a monkey off his back.
Exactly.
That's how he gets on with that. And he'll be itching for that tomorrow.
Big time.
I'm going to go for Tim Merlier.
That's stupid, huh?
Probably, but let's see.
He's got to win coming this year. Tim,
I mean, he will win a stage in this year, I think.
Alpecin and Phoenix are all in for him. Yeah. So, and if not him, possibly Peter Sagan, we should mention.
You almost forget, didn't you? Man.
Yeah, you forget he's there.
Yeah. Peter's like sort of yesterday's man, isn't he? But still such a class act. Yeah. On his day, could produce the Peter of 4 or 5 years ago.
I imagine him winning at least a stage of this year. Maybe a hillier one, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Than a flat one. Like, it's not all flat tomorrow. You've got the... climb in the first half, but I think he's got a win in him
for
sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We look forward to finding out. That brings us to the end of this episode of the Bradley Wiggin Show by Eurosport, brought to you by Zwift, where fun is fast. Orla, welcome back. Great to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been lovely.
Brad, thank you.
Thank you, Graham.
As ever. Go on, where can we follow you both on social media? Where can we find these pictures of Orla riding around Buckingham Palace?
Hidden in the depths of one of our phones, never to
Orla
emerge.
Shinnery, Team Sky launch, 2010 London.
It took us a long time to find them, Bradley. So I'm hoping that, Limonek.
I'm going to do it for you if you're not going to... At Sports Orla is where hopefully we can find these images.
Yep.
Brad, as ever.
Yeah, thank you.
At Sir Wiggo. You can follow Eurosport on Twitter at Eurosport_UK. Plus, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you to our producer, Pete Burton.
Thanks, Pete.
Strapping in for another grand 3 weeks. Finally, from me, Graham Wilgos, it's goodbye. If you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, your thoughts and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Plenty of action to look forward to coming up on Eurosport, where we can join you, and GCN Plus, where we can join you both tomorrow. Orla, looking forward to that. Thanks again for joining us. And Brad,
thank you.
We'll see you for the pod tomorrow.
Brilliant.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.